The Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources, today is the 17th of November. It's a Tuesday, and we're having an informational hearing on climate-related topics. We're going to start with a presentation from the Oregon Global Warming Commission on their biennial report to the legislature. Then we will move into a presentation from some folks from California and a little bit of question and answer from the committee to them about the California climate program. And then we'll have a presentation from the state forester, Department of Forestry folks about wildfire here in Oregon, and particularly where we are now, where we've been, what the trends look like. And then I will say just a few words about the pending climate legislation that I think probably most of you have heard about, and where things might end up going as we ramp up to the 2016 session. So with that, any questions from members of the committee before we get going? I will note that this is an informational hearing. It is for the purposes of getting informational presentations for the committee members. We will not be taking public testimony today. We will, as we develop climate legislation for the 2016 session, we will have more hearings prior to the February legislative session starting, and we will take lots of public testimony and lots of input and lots of stakeholder input between now and then. I just wanted to get that out there in case anybody is here with the intention of providing public testimony. So with that, why don't we get going with the Oregon Global Warming Commission representatives, Alan Salenka and Jessica Shipley. Welcome. And Alan Salenka is one of my favorite city councilors from my city of Eugene, but also a member of the Global Warming Commission. So I welcome you.
Grab that mic.
Do we have
And we have slides.
Do I need to do it?
Go ahead. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Alan Salenka. Commission Chair Angus Duncan couldn't be here today, so he asked me to give you the presentation. And that's where we'll go right now. And hopefully, I'll just page down. The Global Warming Commission was created back in 2007. It has 11 voting members and 25 altogether, including some senators like Senator Edwards, and representatives and the heads of all the key departments in the state. And the commission's general charge is to recommend ways to coordinate state and local efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon consistent with our goals, and to recommend efforts to help the state and local businesses and government and residents prepare for the effects of global warming. And we do that through recommended statutory and administrative changes, policy measures, and other actions, but also tracking and evaluating global warming impacts on Oregon policies, costs, risks, benefits, and in our progress towards moving to achieve our reduction goals. And we are required to make a report to the legislature every 2 years, which is why we're here. We had prepared two reports. The full report, which if you have insomnia, it's available for you online, and then the 14-page summary report that is also available. And today I'll describe, what we're going to do is describe the latest greenhouse gas emissions inventory, and Jessica Shipley from ODO, who is assigned to the commission to do our work, will walk you through the inventory and forecast. And then I will finish off by talking about one of the ways, of the possible many ways, to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. Jessica.
Okay, great. So Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Shipley, and as Alan mentioned, one of my roles at the Oregon Department of Energy is to provide technical staff support to the Global Warming Commission. In preparing their 2015 biennial report, one of the first questions the commission wanted to answer was where Oregon's emissions are currently, and secondly, the trajectory of emissions going forward into the future. So this graph on this slide shows you the historical emissions in the state, also frequently referred to as our greenhouse gas inventory. The data for this emission inventory comes primarily from actual emissions reported to Oregon DEQ through the mandatory reporting program. And you can see that Oregon's emissions peaked in 1999 and have been mostly declining or flat since 2007. Thank you. So this graph shows the same historical emissions as the last slide, but now I've added the linear trajectory between the state's 2020 and 2050 emission reduction goals. So you can see that on the orange line on this graph. And also those two goals are shown in the red text above the graph. And as I mentioned, the commission also wanted to see a forecast for where our emissions are headed in the future, also known as the business as usual scenario. This forecast is meant to show what will happen to our emissions in the absence of any additional changes beyond what we already know about today. So for this report, we used a methodology that's very similar to those that have been used in past commission reports. We use a state-level emission projection tool published by the US EPA. The tool generates a forecast for the state using national and regional data that is scaled down to Oregon. One unique thing about our projection is that we use an Oregon-specific electric sector forecast, thanks to the utilities for providing us the data on their load forecasts. And we feel this makes the overall projection more accurate. Similarly, this forecast includes the projected impacts of Oregon's RPS and the emission reductions expected to occur when Boardman ceases coal operations, both of which are included by looking at utility IRP information. And it also includes estimated emission reductions from the Clean Fuels Program and the latest EPA fuel economy standards for light-duty vehicles and trucks. No other additional measures or actions are assumed in this business as usual forecast. So this is a combination of the previous graphs, plus now it has a red line that show the results of that projection modeling that we did for this report that I just described. As you can see, the projection for Oregon's emissions is mostly flat going out to 2035, which is the last year that's available in the latest version of this tool. That red line is the best approximation we have for what Oregon's emissions will look like in the future in the absence of any additional changes or unforeseen shifts. As I mentioned, the orange line shows the simple linear trajectory between the state's 2020 and 2050 emission reduction goals, although 2050 is no longer shown on this graph.
I have a question. So does the horizontal line, the red, does that include the clean fuels rollout?
Senator Dembrough, the red line does include an estimate of the reductions that will occur due to the clean fuels program. Yes. And the last sort of bit of information on this graph that I wanted to point out is that in the report, the commission proposes to begin referring to a 2035 goal, which is also shown there on the orange line. It's just the midpoint between the state's 2020 and 2050 reduction goals. And so it's pointed out on this graph.
Thank you, Jessica. And you know, the question that the commission has been grappling with is that business as usual line and the target line, there's a gap. How do we fill that gap is the major question that we've been dealing with. And what we do to fill that gap is first we assess all of the measures that are available in meaning laws, programs, incentives, policies that we can implement in order to reduce greenhouse gases. And then if we still haven't closed that gap, then we look at the price signals on carbon to close the gap. And the staff, state agency staff, has worked to construct emissions reduction wedges that make up the policies and measures that you can see would reduce the impacts on emissions. So what we do is a sector by sector or analysis. Then we build up those measures that reduce greenhouse gases in each of the sectors, and they're designed to help us close that gap between the business as usual forecast, which includes everything that we've done to date or are planning to do we're committed to do, and the target line, and what we call these measured measures within the sectors are wedges. We call these a wedge analysis. So each wedge represents a sector, and the magnitude or the width of that wedge it will indicate how much greenhouse gas reductions emissions come from each of these different sectors or wedges. So I wanted to stress that the wedge analysis that we show here, and I'll go into each one of these in a little bit more detail, but it is only one of many possible pathways to meet the targets, our interim target of 2035. And it's intended to be illustrative rather than prescriptive. And so this is more of an analytical exercise of showing how we could meet the goals than it is a specific policy recommendation that the legislature should adopt. So each of the wedges.
Go ahead.
Sir. Sure. On your wedge, Senator, on transportation, I see it's pretty broad there. Yeah, that one right there. I get to look at it here, so it's easy for me. Is that transportation carrying out to 2035 take into account all the new hybrids, transport vehicles that we're getting, electric cars that will come into fruition? Or is this just a model that if we do the same business, this is how wide the transportation base is going to be?
It does include changes and efficiencies and increases in electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. So, and I'm going to go through each one of these sectors one by one and show you some examples.
I'm sorry.
We'll actually
answer
your question in just a second, Senator. The first wedge is the energy efficiency sector in the residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. And examples of that are doing residential HVAC improvements, weatherization, lighting, commercial lighting, daylighting controls, commercial appliances, industrial process efficiency. And these emissions assume that energy efficiency is done first because it's the biggest bang for the buck and the best measure that we have for reducing greenhouse gases. And the energy efficiency measures that we implement here would directly result in reductions in natural gas and electric loads. The second wedge or sector is the transportation sector. Senator Olson? And these measures would impact the ground passenger travel, freight, and air travel. And some examples might include reduction of the number of single occupancy vehicles traveled or trips, the increase in the number of electric vehicles and plug-in vehicles. We're assuming that the existing electric vehicle and plug-in fleet goes from the existing about 1% that we have today to 3.6% by 2022 and 43% by 2035. So it's a pretty significant increase for electric vehicles. And
Is that a realistic conclusion to go to 43% electric vehicle? Seeing as our climb right now is relatively small.
Right, you're exactly right. And as you'll see through this whole thing, the theme that's going to be behind all of this is that it's a pretty heavy lift to get to meeting the targets,
okay,
including getting to 43% penetration rate in the market with electric or plug-in vehicles.
Okay, thank you.
Which will require actions and incentives by the state.
Senator Whitson.
I'd just like to emphasize that if you were to graph that, that would be virtually an exponential curve.
It would be pretty steep. Yes, it would, Senator. Yeah.
Kind of like the adoption of smartphones or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been technologies that have grown exponentially. I'm not saying that electric vehicles will, but that's like the type of growth that we'd have to see to hit that.
Point out there, those have been market-driven.
Right. And electric vehicles will have a market-driven component that as they demand increases, supply will increase and the price will start to drop and it will become much more competitive.
Yeah.
And especially we're seeing amazing transitions of battery technology. Example, the Tesla factory that's opening in Nevada.
That's referring to the free market.
Right. And also embedded in this is vehicle improvement, traditional vehicle miles per gallon efficiencies, and an additional 12% above and beyond what we have in existing EPA today. So all of those things combined make up that wedge for transportation. The next wedge comes from the materials and waste sector. And this is basically some of the measures that could come from this sector are biogas energy from solid waste and wastewater treatment plants to create renewable energy, landfill gas collection and either utilization or destruction, and also reducing the embedded carbon in new building materials and prevention of packaging waste are some of the measures that could be included in this sector as well.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
What's your proposal on reducing embedded carbon in new building materials?
Jesse, you got a quick answer for that?
Senator Edwards, Senator Olson. The information on that measure came from some research that's going on currently by Oregon DEQ, and there's much more information we could get you about that measure if you're interested in.
But what, I mean, you've assumed it. What is it?
So it means that the carbon that's embedded in the materials that are used to construct new buildings would be reduced by the exact amount. I would have to get that data from DEQ.
No, I just wonder what materials are you referring to when you're reducing carbon, because a great carbon storage facility is a 2x4 or a 2x6, because it's in the building, it doesn't burn down. Hopefully the building doesn't burn down, it's stored forever. So if you reduce that carbon that's in that material, what are you going to go to, steel, concrete, glass?
Senator Olson, that is information that is in the report, and it is available, and I can get it to you. I just don't have it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
The next sector is in the agricultural sector, and examples of measures that were included in this rather small wedge are use of food waste to create energy, co-digestion of dairy manure to create energy, what we call precision agriculture, which has nutrient management in it, and several other measures to incorporate into the agricultural sector. And the fifth sector is the power generation sector. And for this sector, we don't have specific measures in the plan, but rather we assume that the two largest utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp, would hit their 80% reduction in emissions below the 2005 level by that 2050 target. So 80% below 2005 by 2050. And this would be actions above and beyond the current energy efficiency efforts and the current RPS that they're operating under. And as a result of this, 2035 power plant emissions would be 37% below what they are and what they were in 2013.
So in the power generation, that so energy efficiency was already accounted for in its own slice.
And the RPS.
So this is replacement. I mean, it needs to be some sort of their load projections are going up, or their total needs they're planning for. So this is replacing with less carbon intensive forms. Am I understanding that correctly? This wedge?
Yes, correct. Right. Right. So less carbon intensive forms of generation.
Right. Okay.
Right. And thus the emissions would be reduced as well.
Yeah. Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. PacifiCorp is basically a vertically integrated coal company. Since 2005, PacifiCorp's rates have more than doubled. And if we're going to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050, do you have any idea what that would do to their rates? Do you have an estimate of that? Have you graphed that? Have you do you have a model that?
One of the recommendations that is in our plan is that we do a cost and benefit analysis associated with this plan, the sketch of a plan. It's not at the point where the details would allow us to be able to get at that, Senator, but that is something I think we definitely need to do, which is assess the costs and the benefits and what are the changes that they would be able to do, and take into consideration things like what happens if there's a price on carbon and how that would impact their ability to provide power with in a more greenhouse gas emission friendly way. So we haven't done that yet.
And certainly from the standpoint of the future of economy of Oregon, I think that would be one of the first things you'd want to do.
If we use California as an example, and the climate folks that are here from California can address this probably better than I can, they've been under an RPS and a regime that is actually much more aggressive than ours here in Oregon, and actually they have not seen a dramatic increase in costs associated with meeting the greenhouse gas targets.
If I could follow up, I just drove from Southern Oregon to Anaheim, took our grandkids to Disneyland. we filled up in Klamath Falls at $2.29 a gallon, and 2 days later in Los Angeles, you paid $3.89 a gallon for the same grade fuel. So I'm a little hard put to believe that there are no economic changes there. That's a 71% increase in the price of fuel from driving from Klamath Falls to Los Angeles.
Go ahead. Continue.
So as you can see from this this sector right here, the power generation sector, that all the measures that we had put into each of these five wedges don't quite get us to the target for the state line target, which is that the line, the orange line there. And so we do not meet the reduction goal with just these measures, which brings us to the sixth and final wedge, which is a carbon price associated with pathway. To meet the emission goals, we would also need to add a price signal for carbon. And we worked with the same PSU folks that did the last year's study on the carbon fee that the legislature required. And we asked them to do a slightly different run of this, of a scenario to help us fill in that final piece of the gap between the target and the business as usual case. And what that would entail is a carbon price that would start at $10 a ton and go up every year for 5 years up to $60 a ton. And that would enable us to essentially meet the 2035 target and meet the statewide reduction goals.
No questions on that one? None. Seriously?
He's waiting.
Okay.
All right.
Please.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's mind-numbing. What that would do to Oregon's economy on top of all the rest of it I think it's something that, as I said before, I think that should be, if you haven't done it, it should be your very next task, because it's it will create, this whole system will create an economic atmosphere in Oregon which simply won't be viable. We're going to see, we have to see businesses move to anywhere where they can afford to buy energy.
While we haven't done this, the analysis actually was done for Senate bill that required PSU to do the carbon fee study. The results of that study showed that a carbon fee could be imposed in the state and have very little positive or negative within a very, very narrow band impact on the economy and meet the greenhouse gas reduction goals of the state of Oregon. So the analysis that was done by PSU, and I think is very rigorous, and is also borne out by both British Columbia's experience with their carbon tax, which have seen little to no effect on the economy, and California, who is doing, like I said, much more stringent things than we are, has actually seen a dramatic increase in their economic output over the last 5 years.
And that would be since 2009, since into the crash.
Well, 2006 is when AB 32 or their system went into play, and the cap and trade system, which put a price on carbon, went into effect in 2013, I believe, 2012, and has been actually very stable, but has also reduced emissions without seeing a major impact on the economy at all. In fact, their economy has grown dramatically.
So it's my understanding that in the wedge analysis, okay, so these are the wedges that are needed beyond business as usual. So all of, you know, the additional energy efficiency, transportation, materials and waste, agriculture, power generation, carbon price, I mean, that is a combination of policy decisions, either executive or legislative, are required to move most of those, maybe not quite all of them. I mean, you know, if the market just took off with electric vehicles, that's, you know, that may or may not involve legislative influence. But I mean, I'm bringing that back to the point because these kind folks have been nice enough on a relatively short notice to come give this presentation. They're members of the Global Warming Commission, which has a certain task. The legislature has a different task, and we will be considering economic benefit to parts of Oregon as we move forward in these deliberations. And I want to make that clear that we will be considering those, and different people have different opinions about that, but we're trying to get as much information as we can.
Yeah. Senator, go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
If on your wedges, one of them is insufficient to collapse the wedge like your high estimate of 43% of the EV cars in 2035, what would the what would that do to the cost of carbon to continue that downward curve that you need to make it hit the path? How much would that $60 go up to fill in the gap that you're not going to get in other sectors?
Right. What we have done is actually only one of what could be a multitude of different paths to get there, and it could be and you could do a bunch of scenarios, Senator, to be able to look at trade-offs between what if this didn't happen or this did happen, what would you need to do in a different sector in order to make up for that. We haven't done that yet in terms of this plan. Again, this is just one path of many. It's just illustrative as opposed to prescriptive. The overall plan is kind of a good news and bad news report for you, which is the good news is that we have shown where there is a path to meet the goals. The bad news part of the plan is that none of the things that are in place to meet that goals are in place. And that's where the utilities and the different sectors and the legislature need to act in order to create and enable those actions to occur to meet these goals. And it is a very iterative process that some things will be put into effect and will do better than expected or worse than expected, and we'll have to adjust the plan as you go along. But this is kind of a starting point for how the targets could be met.
Follow?
Yeah.
The interesting thing, though, is you've built this plan, this model, that you make several very enormous assumptions on, and then you say that $60 a ton, this is what we can do. I'm surprised that your model didn't include all the variations that would include, because every time you change one of your wedges, your $60 a ton is going to increase to $100 to $150 a ton. California is up to $100 a ton on their cap and trade. Those are the things that we have to know as legislators before we make a decision on, you know, how's this going to affect the state? It's real simple to say we need to be here. How do we get there, and what does it cost the citizens of Oregon to get to that point for the reduction?
Mm-hmm.
California emits 1% of all greenhouse gas in the world. We're not the size of California. So we're going to spend billions of dollars to get someplace, but nobody really has what we're going to spend, and that's what concerns me.
Right. I absolutely agree with you, Senator. I think that's a very important thing to do, and the resources that the Global Warming Commission has is sitting next to me.
No.
And so our ability to do what you are suggesting, we'd love to be able to do what you're suggesting, but the resources aren't there to be able to do that yet. And those are some of the actions that the Senate and the legislature could take in order to bolster those kind of planning to get the answers to the questions that you have.
Well, then follow up. If we're gonna
press Senator Dembrough's.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Michael.
You know, I think before we take action on anything, we're going to do a lot more modeling and a lot of analysis to get us to the point where we feel comfortable with this. But, you know, looking at it in a slightly different way, these different tranches are not—they're not all mutually exclusive. I mean, as Senator Olson said, but they're also—they can be self-reinforcing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you put if you ultimately have a $60 a ton price on carbon, that's going to have influence on the other wedges, won't it?
Yes.
And make it more likely that those will approach the kinds of targets that you're assuming.
Right. And, Senator, the way that we did the modeling is we assumed all the measures first and then went to look at what would it take in order for a price signal to meet the final wedge, to meet the fill the gap. And if I might, this is what's called a marginal abatement cost curve, and what it was created by state staff, and it shows all the different measures that can occur in the state of Oregon by different kinds of sectors, and how and what their costs are and how much they actually do. So it's a two-dimensional graph. So the wider the bar, the more greenhouse gases it creates, and the lower the bar, the less cost it has, and the higher the bar. And you can see there's quite a bit of measures that actually are a net benefit to the state and some that are a net cost to the state. And one of the things that hasn't been done is what would be the economic impact of going through this, and how would you go through this, and what would be the scenarios to play out in order to get to the optimal plan in the state of Oregon to meet the greenhouse gas reduction targets.
Senator Whissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States are down to about 1997 levels now, give or take a little. And the primary driver of that has not been wind and solar and others, but has been really the advent of very inexpensive natural gas. So has the Global Warming Commission considered, I don't see the use of natural gas anywhere in these projections, what would happen if you further incentivize the free market use of natural gas in lieu of the wind and solar or some of these other deals? I mean, I don't see it. It's not even in your pie chart. So, I find that somewhat alarming, since the primary reduction in greenhouse gases globally over the last 10 years has been from the reduction in advanced use of natural gas. So help me understand why you're not considering that.
Yeah, actually, I think it is considered, Senator. In the power generation, what this assumes is actions taken by PGE and PacifiCorp to get their emissions below 80% below 2005 levels by 2050. And in doing that, they end up having emissions that are 37% lower than they were in 2013. To do that, they need to shift from high carbon intensity generation, coal, to gas and other renewable generation in order to reduce those emissions. So you get the reductions in the greenhouse gases and the air quality benefits, but also shifting to a more cost-effective fuel in order to meet this target. So I think there are power market forces that are incorporated into this in order for these two utilities to meet their targets.
Mm-hmm. I was a little imprecise in my question. I was really referring more to transportation fuels.
Oh, sorry.
There's nothing to be sorry about. I didn't ask the question right.
Yeah, sorry, I misunderstood. So with regard to transportation, there is a embedded in the transportation sector, which is that one, is an increase in fuel economy, about 12% above and beyond what we're doing today, and also more other actions that will increase decrease single occupancy vehicle trips, as well as increase in the electric vehicles and plug-in, and how exactly those play out in the marketplace is we haven't determined that yet. We haven't got that level of detail in that analysis.
Mm-hmm. Alan, what's your professional background?
You're
here for the Global Warming Commission, but you have a related professional background, do you not?
Yeah, as well as a city councilor in Eugene. I'm also the energy director of energy services for Kennedy Jenks, which is a West Coast engineering firm that provides services to industry and water and wastewater and municipal governments. And I mostly do climate action plans for all of these different clients. And an example of some of the things that we've done is to go into an entity and say, you can reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and your energy and have a net decrease in your overall operating to the tune of millions of dollars per organization. And needless to say, boards of directors love those kind of plans. So that's kind of where I come from in terms of my professional
background. You've worked in the energy sector for a while.
And before that, I was a power manager at Emerald PUD in Eugene for over 20 years.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
So I've got 30 years experience in the energy business.
I might have screwed up because I've gone down in your presentation and I found another chart, and I just wanted to ask you about it, if I could. It's a chart that shows total emissions from 1990 to 2012. Do you know where that's at?
Yeah.
No, it's cool. Another one.
Yeah, one more, I believe.
Oh.
Down.
Which chart? I'm sorry, Senator.
It was down lower than questions.
Right there. The untitled chart?
Yeah, the untitled chart. It's quite interesting because when I looked at 2000, our total emissions were 70.8 million metric tons. And we've reduced it to 60.9 million metric tons, which is a 16% reduction in 12 years. So if one would assume this trajectory that we are on at 2035, we would go down another 22% without doing anything, without taxing carbon, without just going on the course that we're on. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, yes, Senator, from 2008 to 2011 or 12 was the recession. So we had a contraction of the economy, and that actually reduced emissions pretty substantially. So the projection moving forward is that we'd have growth in the economy as opposed to contraction of the economy. So that's what it has the graph actually not going dramatically up, but basically flat as the business as usual case. And that also takes into consideration things like the implementation of the RPS and the Clean Fuel Standard and all those other things are already embedded into that. That's what makes it be flat as opposed to going upward.
Well, the Clean Fuel Standard hasn't started. The LCFS hasn't started yet.
Correct. It's embedded into the business as usual forecast.
Senator Whitsitt, and then we need to move on to our next presentation.
With that regard to the same chart there, that ends in 2012. Actually, our economy was recovering from 2009 to 2012 while the emissions dropped almost 5 million metric tons. What have they done since then, 13, 14, and 15? 15 you probably don't have. What about 13 and 14? Are they still going down? Are they coming back up or what?
Jessica, answer that a little better.
Senator, what's it? The complete inventory for 2013 and 2014 is not quite finished. We have partial data for it. We're just waiting on some quality control issues at Oregon DEQ, and we should have that information very soon. But the preliminary indication are that they are roughly flat compared to 2012 levels.
And this graph, Senator, shows where there's a kind of an overlap between historic and where we are today in terms of where the emissions have been going since the recession, which are pretty much downward, and then they kind of flatten out.
Could you go? No, I'll never mind.
Yeah, we've got a presentation from some folks that need to catch a flight, so we need to move on.
We can hold them up.
So,
you guys can't change the flight schedule.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could get with you afterwards, I'd like to, because there's another chart in here that doesn't correlate to what we just talked about.
Oh, okay. Sure, Senator. Certainly.
Thank you both for presenting on relatively short notice, and we appreciate that.
Alan, thank you.
Senator. Next, so we've seen a little bit about where we are and some modeling about where we, what a path forward might look like. One of those pieces is a price on carbon that's embedded in that model. California's done, has handled that in one way. British Columbia's handled it in another way. So we have some folks from California that are going to talk a little bit about the program down there. And Gary and Steve both. I guess we'll start with Gary.
Yes.
Okay. And we invited Gary because he gave a presentation to some legislators during the September legislative days, and it was the clearest explanation that I have seen of the California program. And so I asked that he come back and give it to this committee, and he's been willing on even shorter notice to make the trip up. So thank you. both for being here. And we'll get you out of here by 3:30 because I know you got to have a plane to catch. So
very good. Thank you, Chair Edwards, and thank you for the kind words. What I'm going to present today is a condensed version of that, so hopefully we retain the clarity while getting a little more succinct, going down from an hour to 10 minutes. Do appreciate the invitation to be here today. It's an honor to be able to present to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and so let me just get started. Very quickly, we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We've been in existence since 2001, and our primary role is to set standards for greenhouse gas accounting and ensure compliance against those standards. So we have been very active in that across North America. Start with just setting the context for what's going on, not just in California, but worldwide, because I do hear this comment, and I heard it again today, and I think it's a relevant comment, which is to say, California is a small piece of global warming emissions. Oregon is a small piece of global warming emissions. And the fact is that today, 25% of emissions are under some sort of carbon price, primarily a cap and trade program. And in the next 2 years, with the addition of China and Mexico and South Korea into cap and trade regimes, 50% of emissions globally will be under a carbon price. So this is a growing movement. The idea here is to actually try to build the broad coalition and build it from the ground up, because as we've seen, an international regime from the top down has not been effective to date. So let me turn to California and just talk about the programs that are in place. A lot of this is very similar to what you've just seen. That presentation that you just saw is very familiar to me as a Californian. We went through a very similar kind of analysis. And I think the bottom line is to say that California's climate program under our AB 32, as it's called, that's very annoying, is that This is a myriad of programs that are put together. The carbon cap is just one of them, and they all work together in kind of a cohesive whole. And I think what's really interesting about the California regime, and it's not the only system that's like this, is that the carbon cap, the cap and trade program, is actually not the leading edge of California's efforts. As you can see, we have programs for renewable energy and energy efficiency, the low carbon fuel standard, and clean cars, but it's the trailing edge, and that is to say it's the backstop. So if we don't achieve the emission reductions we intend or have set forth in those other sectors, we can add those emission reductions into the cap and clamp down further so that we do meet our legally mandated goals. So let's talk about the cap and trade program. That's why you invited me here today so graciously, so thank you. There are a few basic steps for any cap and trade program, and this is really kind of fundamentals of cap and trade. The first is that you actually have to set the cap. And how you do that is you look at historic emission levels for the sectors that you're covering, and you say that's the level at which we're setting it. California did that for the year 2012. Then you allocate permits. In the parlance of a cap and trade program, permits are known as allowances. They represent one metric ton of greenhouse gas emissions, and you allocate those, and we can talk about the mechanisms by which you allocate those. At the end of a year, you measure the emissions from each of the covered sources, and they have to have a permit or an allowance for every ton that they emitted. Any individual facility does not have a cap on that facility. They can pollute to the extent up to the total maximum of the cap as long as they can obtain the permits to do so. There is no restriction on individual facilities. It's a cap overall for the economy. At the end of the year, they've measured their emissions. They know how much they put out. They have obtained their allowances. They turn those in. What's called a surrender or a true-up, and you determine that you've been, in fact, in compliance. And there are penalties, of course, if you fail to comply. The next year you do it all over again. You reduce the cap by a couple of percentage. In California, it's been between 2 and 3% a year that the cap has been reduced. And you start this process over again. You allocate permits, you measure emissions, you ensure compliance, and you continue that trajectory downward to make sure that you get to your goals. So in California, as I mentioned, the cap started at the actual emissions in 2012 for the covered sectors, and it's going to decline by about 15% by 2020. Our program has a goal that emissions are legally mandated to be reduced by 20% from 1990 levels by the year 2020. And so that's where the cap at this point goes through. The sectors that are included, and this is part of any sort of cap and trade program design, you think about who you want to have covered and how you want to cover them and when you want to cover them. In California, we first covered the electric utility sector, the refineries and the manufacturers starting in 2012, and in this year we added in transportation fuels and suppliers of natural gas. So it doesn't all have to come in at the beginning. You can phase in the program. One of the key things is how do you distribute these allowances? How do you as a policymaker or regulator decide to distribute allowances? And there's a range. You can 100% auction them all. You can just put them up to auction and sell them. And economists will tell you that's the way to get the purest price signal. You can 100% give them away. You can give them to every facility that's covered and say, okay, here's your allowances. Now, you guys, if you want to reduce emissions on site and sell some of your allowances, feel free. California has chosen a hybrid approach. Most programs, quite honestly, use a hybrid approach where there is a certain amount of free allocation to the sectors and auction, and that's exactly what we've done. The goal, because of the necessity of having a strong price signal, is to actually move to full auction in the future, but not by 2020. California is looking at full auction in a post-2020 scenario. One of the key components of cap and trade is, in fact, the flexibility. You're bringing market forces to bear. You're trying to create as cost-effective and flexible a program as possible to reduce compliance costs on businesses to the maximum extent feasible. You want to achieve your environmental objectives, but you want to create the least amount of harm to the economy. And so how you do that, there's a number of flexibility and cost containment mechanisms that California has imposed. The first are offsets, and I'll talk a bit about those in some subsequent slides, but California has allowed for offsets to be part of the program. They also allow companies to bank the allowances they have for future use. So if we've given you allowances this year and you don't need them all, you can actually save them up for next year or future years. We also, and some of this is the legacy of what we had seen in electricity deregulation, recognize that you need to manage price spikes. And so California has put aside 4% of the allowances, and every time there's an auction, puts those up as available for sale at set prices that will help tamp down any future price spikes. So far, prices haven't come anywhere close to where that containment reserve is, but we have a containment reserve that provides assurance to the market that prices are not going to skyrocket, that they're actually going to be contained. So I think, as I've talked to state regulators preparing for today, in fact, I think the one of the key points to make about the California cap and trade program is that to date it's been very boring. It has gone along. People don't know that it's in existence. It runs very smoothly. There's been no hiccups. Every auction has sold out except one, and that was very close to 98% of the allowances were sold. Prices are near the floor but a little bit above. And it's had very little actual impact on business community in California.
So what type of price range has there been?
So the prices have been at about $10.70 for current vintages. Future vintages, we do auction two vintages at a time. Future vintages at a little bit above that, $10.81, something like that, in the most recent auction. Senator.
Yeah, sir.
What is chair? Was there a program to stockpile allowances ahead of time? in California?
No. When the program started, there had no allowances had been issued. The allowances were only issued once the program had begun. Nothing was provided in terms of allowances prior to the launch of the program. However, and this is an important point, offsets were allowed to be stockpiled, and there were what are known as early action offset credits, recognizing that when California adopted its cap and trade, or when it adopted its Global Warming Act in 2006, that sent a signal to the market that emission reductions were going to be valued. And people actually started reducing emissions starting in 2006 in anticipation of a future market. Mm-hmm. California made very clear in its AB 32 that any early actors would be recognized and rewarded. And so there were, trying to recall, about 20 million early action offsets, I think, that have been recognized in the program.
Follow up, please.
Yeah, follow up.
So to what extent has that that stockpile of early offset credits been utilized, and what will happen to your prices when there is no longer a reserve?
So in the first true-up, only about 2% of the early action offsets were used, even though companies were entitled to use up to 8%. We just finished the second true-up, and we haven't had public release of the data to know, but we expect that it probably is closer to the 8%. But since the program has been enacted, offsets continue to be generated from those projects and from new projects, so that that initial pool of early action offsets may eventually be used up, and I think the projections are probably over the next couple of years. But new offsets continue to be generated and used in the system.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
How large is the agency that oversees AB 32?
The agency in total is, I believe, 1,000 people, but they do lots of other things besides cap and trade. The cap and trade program, I think, is maybe 20 people, something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. I didn't hear you answer the question, what would you project would be when the offset credit bank is used up, what will be the effect on the cost of future credits or the allowances?
I guess the two parts to that response, Senator. First, offsets I don't expect will ever be fully used up because they continue to be generated. That said, a number of market analysts have done price projections within the California cap and trade looking actually out to 2030. And those price projections tend to say that California prices will remain low, probably in the $15 to $20 range long term. So not significantly above where they are now, accounting for inflation.
Thank you.
So let me thank you, Senator, for asking about the offsets. Let me talk a bit about offsets. That's part of and core to what we do at the Climate Action Reserve. The role of offsets, and let me first start by defining what they are. An offset is an emission reduction that has occurred somewhere from outside of the cap. So these are not emission reductions at one company that they're selling to another. These are emission reductions completely outside of the capped sectors that are allowed to be used within the parameters of the program for compliance by the capped entities. And the purpose for them really is to help maintain a cost-effective program to provide that sort of economic efficiency or price pressure relief. I think the most important part for offsets, and we've certainly seen this in California, is that we have not capped by deliberate design the agricultural and the forestry communities. We have said to the agriculture and forest communities, we want to provide you with an economic incentive to reduce emissions. You, if you undertake actions to sequester carbon, reduce emissions, will actually make money on the California cap and trade program by selling those emission reductions to the compliance entities. And that has been part of why the California program, I think, has been successful, is because this is a way of incenting sectors that otherwise, I think, would have been significantly opposed to the program.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Could you give us an example how agriculture or forestry would be able to sell their sequestered carbon, and how do they do it?
Sure. In the forest sector, a change in management, there's three ways. You can reforest, you can change management practice, or you can permanently conserve a forest that's under threat of destruction. Primarily what we've seen is people making a deliberate commitment to change the way they manage their forests, and this is a long-term commitment. It's a 100-year commitment, so we're not talking about, yeah, I'm going to change the way I harvest today and 20 years from now go back and harvest. These are legally binding commitments. But then that forest grows bigger trees, more trees, and that carbon is actually counted. Every year there's an analysis done. Credits are generated, and those credits are sold to compliance entities.
Isn't there an offset in the forestry industry then with jobs and employment? If you lock a forest up for 100 years, you can't cut it. You lose all the opportunity to market that wood, and you lose all those forestry jobs. So how do you balance that?
Right. So, Senator, I think that's a good question. The way that California designed its forest program is that it doesn't require that you lock up all of the wood. All it requires is that you increase the total amount of carbon stored in the forest over time. So if your forest is growing at this rate, you can harvest down to this rate and you're still above baseline, you can generate credit for that delta and continue to harvest. And in fact, California wanted to have a program that worked for working forests.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would like to follow up on that. Once you harvest timber, assuming that, as Senator Olson said in a previous query, when you harvest the timber and you build something with it, the carbon is sequestered in that building as long as the building is there. So do you have a offset or some type of price relief for those who are harvesting their timber and actually selling it to people to build houses and so forth?
So built into the calculations for the program is what happens to the carbon in the wood products over the lifetime. And this is, again, we're looking at a 100-year cycle here, not a short-term cycle. And over a 100-year cycle, what most of the analysis has shown is that the carbon does, in fact, get re-released back into the atmosphere. Most wood buildings are not going to continue to stand for 100 years. They tend to get landfilled at a certain point. And those are based on the scientific studies we've seen.
I'd like to see the assumptions made there, but go ahead.
Well, let me move along. So California does allow for six specific offset project types. As I mentioned, the forestry, urban forestry is also allowed. Livestock methane capture and destruction, so these are dairy and swine farms. The destruction of ozone-depleting substances, these are gases that are contained in refrigerators and HVAC units, the methane that might otherwise leak from a mine that is captured and destroyed, and the cultivation of rice. California does grow a fair amount of rice. There's a protocol. It does apply in other states as well. The projects in the California Cap and Trade can be located anywhere in the United States. And, in fact, there are projects here in Oregon. I'll show you the map in a moment. They need to go through a rigorous system for checking and verification, of course. So here's the map. This is not just projects in the California Cap and Trade. Our program at the Climate Action Reserve also has offset projects that are used in voluntary markets by companies like Disney and Google to offset their emissions. But we do have three projects in Oregon, and you can see there's a livestock waste management project that is actually actively generating offset credits and selling those into the California market. That's in Tillamook. So the other key issue to think about in design of a cap-and-trade program is how you might use the auction revenue that is generated through the program. And in general, revenue can be used for any number of purposes, general tax relief. Sometimes that's called cap-and-dividend. It can go into the general fund. It can go into public works projects, transportation projects. California has a legal requirement that says that the fees generated here through the cap and trade auction must be used on programs that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we're not offsetting our general fund. We're not. We are providing some dividends.
Mr. Chair, I have an article from the Wall Street Journal that says in 2013 the state borrowed $500 million from the cap and trade program to balance the state general fund budget. Doesn't sound like it was used for an offset.
I think there's a, Senator, there's an interesting question there whether borrowing is legal or not. The state had determined that it was. Those funds have been paid back already. The other interesting element of the use of auction revenue for California anyway is that we had an additional state law enacted that said that 25% of all revenues must be directed towards disadvantaged communities. That 25% in fact has become kind of the floor, but last year 33% of the revenues were used in disadvantaged communities for things like low-income weatherization, energy efficiency, increased transportation services in the communities.
Yeah, and, go ahead.
Those projects, are they spread out around the state? Are they focused on the urban areas? Are they in the rural areas?
No, they're very much in rural areas. California, we went through a detailed assessment to determine with screening criteria what were, in fact, how do you define a disadvantaged community? And disadvantaged communities were clearly recognized to occur in rural areas in the state as much as in urban areas. So the funds have been distributed quite broadly. So just, and I'm not going to go through everything here in the interest of time, but in the current fiscal year, the estimate was about $2.2 billion raised through the auctions. And you can see the kinds of programs in which funds are being put, affordable and sustainable housing, the low-carbon transportation, energy efficiency projects, a whole wide range of programs. So the state is spreading the money around. So the last thing I wanted to address was just what we have seen in California since the adoption of AB 32, because it has been instructive. I took note of the question earlier about jobs and job impacts in California. And in fact, the California manufacturing sector has had four consecutive years of growth of manufacturing jobs in the last 4 years. And so we have clearly seen that these kinds of programs are not anathema to economic growth and, in fact, go hand in hand with economic growth, and there's data to demonstrate that. The California economy continues to grow, in fact, growing faster than that of the rest of the nation significantly, and you can see that. And you can see that emissions continue to decrease. So emissions per GDP are declining while economic and GDP is growing. And I think what's particularly instructive or interesting is what has happened in the clean economy. The point of these programs is really to transition the California economy and anybody who adopts these kinds of programs from a fossil fuel dirty economy to a future clean economy from the, say, the 20th century to the 22nd century, the 21st century. And this chart, I think, what's interesting shows that if you look at the line on the bottom, the total economy in California, you can see, like everybody else, we suffered from the economic downturn of 2008, 2009 quite sharply. But that downturn did not affect the core clean economy. In fact, that sector continued to grow and grow at high levels. We now have over 1 million solar jobs in California. And so there is a clear signal that's being sent to investors in clean technology and the clean industries that California has put policies in place. They have a framework for policies in place. They have a carbon price in place to encourage investment in the clean energy economy, and that's starting to pay off.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Would that clean economy have grown without the state legislative mandates to make renewable portfolio standards, solar, wind energy? Without those mandates, that economy, that job growth wouldn't have certainly accelerated that high.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting to ask those questions, sort of counterfactual questions. What would have happened in the absence of? I suppose you make some assumptions and you wonder whether they would have or not. I think most people in California don't believe they would have, and they certainly wouldn't have in the degree that to which the jobs are there.
Thank you.
Yeah, so
Regarding your clean core economy, it's been pretty clear that Tesla has had great success in the stock market. It's also clear that virtually 100% of their capitalization is the result and can be attributed directly to state and federal subsidies, almost 100%. So how much of this clean, core clean energy economy, how much of that is actually attributable to subsidies to wind farms and solars and that sort of thing? Have you studied that?
I'm afraid I don't have that specific answer. But it's, I'm sure.
Subsidize. I mean, you said it's clear. That's the first time I've heard that. So
half a dozen different articles in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
I can get them for you.
I'd like to see that. Thank you.
So that actually concludes what I was here to at least present, but I am happy to answer questions. And again, I'm honored to have been asked to present
you're
here today.
Plenty of time then, aren't you?
Yeah, I've got lots of time.
Well, we're not done.
Somebody else is in trouble.
I have the earlier flight. good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me. Chair Edwards and Vice Chair Olson, I really appreciate being here today. I appreciate being in a state where it's raining. That made me very happy as a Californian. So, my name is Steve Frisch. I'm the president of the Sierra Business Council, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization that works on economic development in northeastern California. We are the most rural area of California. We have the lowest population density of anywhere in the state of California. We work on regional issues that include working farms, ranches, forests. We have a strong tourism economy and service sector economy, less strong manufacturing and industrial base. And our organization also works on climate action planning with local governments in northeastern California on energy efficiency and on renewable energy projects in that region. And California has a broad range of planning infrastructure for meeting its AB 32 targets. But in most of rural California, the planning to implement that is done at the local level by local governments, which gives them the opportunity to come up with local implementation strategies, which we think is very important because it can be tied to local economic development objectives. And we have been focusing a lot of our attention, especially through the Small Business Development Center that we manage, on that issue. The primary mechanism for implementing California's climate policy at the local level in areas outside of kind of urban metropolitan planning areas is the climate action plans. At the local government level, climate action plans establish a baseline of greenhouse gas emissions to measure activities against. They create an emission reduction plan and implementation strategy, and then monitor activities and measure results towards achieving that goal. Most of the rural jurisdictions that we work in have just started this process in the last 2 or 3 years and are just at the point where they're beginning to implement their climate action plans or their energy action plans. There are a variety of reasons why local governments engage in this activity, but I want to talk a little bit more about the business sector and how the business sector in this largely rural region has responded to this issue. And first, I should say that in 2006, when our organization began tracking this process, most of our membership was very skeptical. We have 4,000 small business members. Most of them employ 10 employees or less. And I think that there was a lot of fear in that business sector that the cap and trade program and California's broader climate policies, which Gary laid out for you, would have a significant negative impact. But I think businesses got involved for a variety of reasons. One, of course, was the point that if there was a chance that this was going to lead to regulatory policy, they wanted to be at the table. And quite frankly, between 2006 and today, as these programs are being implemented across the state, business has been very strongly at the table, involved in the development of the programs, involved in what sorts of mitigation and adaptation strategies could be adopted. I think there was another reason why business was involved in this process, and that was that increasingly in California, we've been looking at this as a risk mitigation strategy, that for whatever reason and whatever you think the cause is, there have been increasing incidents of, for example, wildfire, drought events, extreme weather events that have actually put business at risk for supply chain interruption, loss of data and customer base, and really increased costs related to the impact of climate change. And then third, and I think most important and most relevant to how cap and trade revenue can be invested, was to increase competitiveness and take advantage of the opportunity of the revenue streams in order to meet broader economic development goals or economic expansion goals in their industries or in the communities they work in. As Jerry illustrated in his presentation, the California Cap and Trade Program was designed to implement state policy. It's created a substantial source of funding to assist local government and the business sectors. In last year's 2014-2015 budget, cap and trade generated revenue deposited into a greenhouse gas reduction fund were approximately $800 million. In California's 2015-2016 budget, as Gary mentioned, it's approximately $2.3 billion in cap and trade funding being distributed through a variety of programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As the program is implemented, it's estimated that there will be approximately $5 billion per year going into those programs from the cap and trade program. And they cover a broad range of greenhouse gas emission reduction activities, including building workforce housing adjacent to job centers, improving transportation infrastructure to reduce vehicle miles traveled, building electric vehicle charging networks. I was interested in Oregon's projection of 43% electric vehicles. I think California's projection is in the high 50s. One of the necessities for that to happen is to have the infrastructure in place and gradually increasing across the state. So there's a significant effort going into building charging networks, particularly in rural regions now. Most urban regions are addressing the issue. Improving urban transportation, energy efficiency in public buildings, low-income energy efficiency, reducing costs of emissions associated with moving water. 20% of California electricity is used for moving water in the state, so it's a pretty significant sector. And then, of course, agricultural land, wetland.
25% of?
20% of California's electricity is used to move water.
Total electricity.
Total electricity.
Total, not just like in the ag sector.
No, total electricity. 20% of our electricity is to use to move water from one area of the state to another. So lifting all that water up over the Grapevine into the LA Basin is a very expensive and greenhouse gas emitting activity.
Actually, I believe our Dalles Dam provides you with a lot of that electricity.
Some of it, yes.
Okay. I'm going to follow
up on that. So, California. Wait, hold on, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah,
Do you have you identified alternatives to the use of electricity to move water, such as other forms of energy or desalination, so that you don't have to lift water over the Grapevine? Because of course, California is the breadbasket of the world. If you stop moving water, you can see what happened in the Westlands. It doesn't. It's pretty stark. So, do you have some alternative plans?
So, at the same time that California has been implementing its cap and trade and climate policies, of course, we've been in a historic drought, 1,200-year drought, actually. The strategies to deal with future water use and water supply, I think, are being developed now and are pretty aggressive. The the probably the best way to deal with the water energy nexus issue is to not have to lift the water over the grapevine. With recycling, reuse, water conservation in urban areas, there are broad sections of the Los Angeles Basin now that are looking at putting in underground cisterns to trap stormwater as it's developed. There's a $1 billion project going into Los Angeles to desalinate groundwater in their groundwater basin and to remove perchlorate pollution that has aggregated there from the aerospace industry over the years. So there are a number of strategies that are being developed to try to reduce the use of electricity for water and also to increase water sustainability. But big issue in our state, of course.
Just one little follow-up. Yep. Drive down the Central Valley. You look at the incredible expansion of orchards and vineyards, particularly nut orchards. Most of those are all now on drip irrigation where there's just an allocate enough water to grow the plant. But that also is very, it conserves water, but it's very extensively energy efficient and energy costly because you have to, you know, somehow you have to get a few drops of water at each tree each day.
Yeah, interestingly enough, though, that the life cycle analysis on that shows that agricultural energy efficiency and looking at the water energy nexus in the agriculture industry is a net greenhouse gas emission reducer. That because you're moving less water in order to irrigate, in essence, by increasing energy efficiency in agriculture, you're reducing, or water efficiency in agriculture, rather, you're reducing energy use and thus improving energy efficiency. So you might be flood irrigating an almond orchard and using 25, you know, to 50 gallons per tree, but if you're drip irrigating, you might be using considerably less. So, but yeah, all of these strategies, I think, are being looked at, and part of the intent of using the cap and trade funds is to be able to invest in agricultural energy efficiency to see where these savings can be made and increase the competitiveness of the projects, of the products. So,
sorry,
Jim.
Go ahead.
California is currently tracking all of the projects that have been invested in through cap and trade on a website, which I'm providing here for you, but the other reason I'm providing it is so that you can kind of barely see Northeastern California, the region that we're working in and that we're talking about today, Assembly District 1. And I'm going to give you an example of a couple of projects that have been developed and advanced using cap and trade funding within this region. So the Truckee Rail Yard Project is a project. So in this last year, with $800 million distributed in the cap and trade revenues, Assembly District 1, and remember there are 80 assembly districts in California, so this is 1/80th of the money distributed, right, received funding in the following areas. So $4 million in affordable housing, $4 million in transit infrastructure, $261,000 in transit services. Most of this was for rural transit networks to improve service in rural areas or to improve equipment. Much of that equipment, by the way, is getting switched over to natural gas. So $1.3 million for wetland restoration, $2.1 million for forest restoration, $1.4 million in biomass utilization, and $300,000 in energy efficiency. So this is revenues from the cap and trade program, remembering that California has other climate programs as well tied to the Renewable Portfolio Standard, Low Carbon Fuel Standard, and others.
Yes, Senator Nebron.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So are those funds distributed to districts in a block grant, or how did...
So they're distributed through a competitive grant program through about 13 different agencies that actually receive the fund from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. So cap and trade revenues are generated. As they're generated, the public portion of them go into the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. The legislature creates the programs within the agencies to distribute the funding, and then almost all of them are distributed via competitive grant programs. So.
Different comments. Sure. Bruce, you probably should comment on the size of that congressional district, or that because it's not, you know, there's very few people there, and it's a very it's a huge district. If you recall.
It is a huge district. It's probably the closest I would say to Oregon's landscape. Heavily forested, 80% federal land ownership in the southern two-thirds of the district. Goes over to the Klamath Basin, the Modoc Plateau. Very, very rural region.
My guess it would be about 30% of the size of Oregon.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't think it's I can big. Answer that question. It's a big district.
Is that where you're from?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. It's even bigger than Benz's district.
Yeah.
Okay.
But let's also remember, you know, this is an interesting issue because one of the issues that comes up is how do we equitably distribute funding from programs like this? So, geographically large district, but California has 80 assembly districts. So, you know, 1/80th of the $800 million would be, what, $10 million. And this district, which is largely a rural district, received $13.5 million in the first round of funding. So, you know, one thing I think we are seeing in California is that although there is, of course, kind of difference of opinion about what should be invested in, the ability of the money to get out into both rural and urban regions of the state is beginning to prove out, which is good. So I'm going to just quickly highlight a couple projects so you can see the types of things that could be invested in. So the Truckee Rail Yard project is a redevelopment of a former mill site and railroad switching yard located in Truckee, California. Actually, when I moved to the community, that lumber that mill was still in operation. I kind of miss it being in operation in the center of town. The three phases total approximately 320 units of housing, including affordable market rate and live work units, 80,000 square feet of commercial space, and 20,000 square feet of civic space. The project is immediately adjacent to Truckee's historic downtown, providing housing next to a major job center. We ran the econometric model known as M-Plan, which is used nationally to model economic impacts of real estate development on this site. And according to the M-Plan model, which has an accuracy of roughly plus or minus 5%, this project will create 113 permanent jobs, creates about 127 temporary jobs from construction, and it increases the annual local economic activity by $36 million a year and local tax revenue by $2.5 million per year. And I think one of the really interesting things about this project is it illustrates how cap and trade funding can be used to meet these multiple objectives in rural communities for job centers and job creation, housing, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by reducing vehicle miles traveled at the same time. So the second project I'm going to show you is a project in Crescent Mills, California, which is along the North Fork of the Feather River. So it's a very timber-dependent community. And this project is a former Louisiana Pacific mill site. It was previously zoned heavy industrial. It has access to a 5,000 kilovolt power line, so it was a perfect location to do biomass utilization. There's water and power on the site, a PG&E substation, and this site is being repurposed after being vacant for the last 28 years, being repurposed as a community woodlot, which will be used to gather woody biomass, process it into chips, and then the chips will be used to replace fossil fuel burning units in seven public buildings in the surrounding community, the community college, the county offices and planning buildings, the hospital, and about four other entities. The Forest Service has a facility there that will be switching to thermal biomass. The total production will only be about 3.5 kilowatts of power, but it will actually pay for itself in the technology installation in savings in energy costs in 11 years. So this is an example of repurposing a former mill site for use for new biomass production. There is enough space on this site that later on we could do a combined heat power facility here if we wanted to, which is something that we are really interested in doing. And this is yet another example, I think, of how cap and trade funding can be used to seed other investments. So there's actually a small amount of cap and trade funding that went into this through a CAL FIRE grant. But that was matched with money from the California Energy Commission to work on the technology for the site, and money from the U.S. Department of Energy to help look at the engineering studies that were necessary to transfer the public buildings from fossil fuel to woody biomass units. So this would create 21 jobs in a community with an unemployment rate, by the way, of over 13% still, and about $3.8 million a year in local economic activity. So the last thing I want to mention is some of the lessons learned from the rural regions of California in implementing cap and trade to date. And the first is that I think it's incredibly important, if you're looking at pricing carbon, to plan in advance for what your rural investment is going to look like so that the program ensures that you can share benefit across the entire state. And to do that, incorporating data and analysis on potential investments in greenhouse gas reduction strategies on working lands and agriculture is particularly important. Coming up with ways to quantify your greenhouse gas emission reductions from those sectors. It's a lot easier to quantify emission reductions from taking a vehicle off the road than it is from managing a forest, for example. So thinking about that in advance and working on quantification methodology simultaneously to developing a program. And then considering rural vehicle miles traveled strategies is very important as well. Interesting statistic that we found in this process that I think surprised everyone in California is that investments in rural housing next to job centers actually reduces vehicle miles traveled more than investments in urban centers, because rural residents travel further to get to their amenities. So when you start figuring out what the total greenhouse gas emission reductions can be from rural strategies, you might be surprised that housing is a pretty significant strategy. Create mechanisms to ensure equity. Gary mentioned California's 25% disadvantaged community standard. We think it would make sense to think in advance about how to drive investment into all regions and all sectors. That there are some communities that are harder to reach than others are. So whether you look at that as a disadvantaged community standard or disproportionately affected standard by the economic impacts, coming up with some way to address that issue up front would make sense. And one strategy that is beginning to be talked about in California is coming up with, instead of a single statewide strategy around many of these programs, regionalizing the strategies to meet regional targets and goals rather than looking at it simply across the entire state. Valuing natural resource functions up front, hard to measure an ecosystem function and all of the benefits that are derived from it. But if you're going to be investing, for example, in the forest sector, we should be looking at the combined impact of a carbon investment, an energy investment or biomass utilization, a risk reduction strategy for wildfire. So integrating that look at working lands is incredibly important because it can actually amplify the impact of your investments. And then finally, this issue of looking at co-benefits and integrating across programs. So California has 13 agencies implementing, I think it's 17 different programs. One of the issues that we think anyone approaching this with fresh eyes should think about is how you integrate that programs in individual communities so you can look at the impact of transportation, housing, water, forest, energy strategies aggregately on kind of local economies and local opportunity. And then I think one of the things that's really important that we're discovering, we were skeptics. I will admit that our businesses were definitely skeptics of this program. But increasingly what they're discovering is that the program revenues can be leveraged to advance new industries in the region, that we are beginning to focus on using the revenue to repurpose previously used industrial sites in rural regions, which is an incredibly important strategy. Just in my region, we have 160 closed mill sites in the Sierra Nevada. And that combined with cost savings to businesses that can come from investments in energy efficiency and other areas can be a powerful economic incentive for small business to be involved in implementing these programs. So that's my story.
Thank you, Steve. Other questions for?
He's got to leave.
I know he has to leave.
Don't want to hold you up.
Where exactly are you from? And you said our businesses were skeptical. How would you characterize it? Who is our business?
So we have about 4,000 members in our business network, and most of our businesses, more than 85% of our businesses, are small businesses with 10 employees or less. Most of them are in service sector industries, real estate, financial services, mostly retail, frankly. We're a very tourist-dependent region of the state of California. But we also have timber and mining interests. Sierra Pacific Industries is a member of our organization. Collins Pine, once Roseburg Timber was, but they're kind of out of our region now. There are also big businesses in our confederation. Ski industry as well. So,
thank you. The questions?
It's very helpful.
Thank you both for coming and sharing some context and perspective about what is happening in California. And it's useful for us as we contemplate what to do in Oregon. So thank you both for making the trip up, and safe travels.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, next we are going to pivot to a discussion on wildfire in Oregon. And so we have, I believe, Doug Decker, the state forester, and Doug Graff, the deputy fire chief from ODF. And Senator Bertschinger, you want to join us at the dais? Senator Bertschinger is going to join us. He's had an ongoing interest in forest fires and keeping his finger on the pulse of what's happening with fires.
Green forests.
So, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
Floor is yours.
Very good.
And thank you for your patience. We're only 40 minutes behind schedule.
Okay. Well, we'll catch up. How are you doing on time? What is your schedule?
We're fine. We're fine. Okay. So,
good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I serve as the Oregon State Forester, the director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined this afternoon by Doug Graff. Doug's the chief of our Fire Protection Division for ODF. Very interesting conversation. Wasn't able to sit in on all of the last hour, but pieces of it. We're interested and supportive of the committee's exploration of carbon. And your interest in the role of forests and fire and smoke relative to carbon and carbon emissions and carbon sequestration. While we have at the Department of Forestry, we have a general knowledge of these dynamics. Our agency's primary area of expertise, which Chief Graff is going to walk through here in a moment, is really in here today for you, is to characterize recent wildfire frequency and intensity. We're going to try to identify future risk of catastrophic fire. And then characterize some of the wildfire smoke emissions based on our collaboration with Oregon DEQ and our smoke management plan. So that's kind of the picture we're gonna portray. An interesting conversation there about the opportunities for investment that I just heard about. We're really gonna focus on fire and fire risk. There is a lot of scientific data, some of which you've sampled today, and discussion about the relationship between forests and fire and smoke and carbon. And we work very closely with the Oregon State University College of Forestry and the Pacific Northwest Research Station at the Forest Service as our science and research arm. And I think that they're, I know that they will have insights that they can share with you on these topics. So for background, I know each of you knows this very well. ODF, we provide fire protection on 16 million acres of forest, all state-owned forest land, all private forest land, and then Bureau of Land Management on the west side. By statute, by reputation, we are known for aggressively and safely fighting fires. That's what we do. We control the vast majority of fires that we have at less than 10 acres. Some do escape initial attack, particularly when we have conditions like we have right now in the third year of our drought. We do work very closely with private landowners and with contractors, with our federal partners and local cooperators in what we call a complete and coordinated system for fire protection. That means we share a lot of firefighting resources and expertise. So this afternoon, Doug is going to, Chief Graff is going to offer a series of data sets that will show you what the trends are looking like relative to fire size and fire occurrence, increasing smoke emissions from wildfire, and a significant and growing risk of fire, particularly on the federal estate in eastern Oregon. So with that, Doug.
Thank you, Doug. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff, Chief Fire Protection, Oregon Department of Forestry. As Doug mentioned, I'll highlight those key items. Today's report is not a summary of the fire season, but I'm versed in that arena, certainly through the day, and if there's any follow-up questions on where we stand, be prepared to answer those questions. But I will focus on the details and the ask for the day. And the first slide I'd like to highlight, I'll spend a little time absorbing this. This is in the last six decades of data, just raw data on acres burned and numbers of fires for the ODF protection. So the 16 million acres fire protection for the Department of Forestry does not include the complete protection responsibility across the state, including BLM on the east side and Forest Service lands. What strikes you quickly is the top line represents the numbers of fires annually. And you can see we range from 1,600 fires to 700 fires on a good year. A bad year is up in the 1,600 numbers of fires. But we tend to be in that 10-year average, about 1,000 fires a year. And that's generally been consistent across the year. So that's of interest. You can look at the first and the second half of that slide deck there, and on the right side you can see intensity of acres burned, more frequency of large acres across ODF's protection landscape, specifically the last 3 years. And I'll really focus in on the last 3 years as you look across that graph. Truly unprecedented to have the consecutive back-to-back complicated years that we've had. So 10-year averages, as we look at numbers of fires, is about 1,000 fires. Today we sit at 1,065 fires, so just above our 10-year average. 10-year average for acres burned is about 27,000 acres burned, and currently we're at approximately 90,000 acres, so three times our 10-year average for this year. And those are consistent numbers in that range for the last 3 years.
Yeah, Senator, what's it?
Doug, would you point out, I can't read it from here, there's this, you know, the spike in the last 3 years, and then you go back to the next high peak over there. What year is that?
2007.
The next one over there?
2001 and 2 were back-to-back complicated years.
And then back
years.
Over, I mean.
And then the next one was 87.
86 and 87.
Yeah, complicated.
And you don't go back to, like, the Tillamook burn on that?
No. 1960.
All the way back here is 1960. Thank you for the clarity, sir. And then 61 was a big year. So that's the range.
Go ahead.
Doug, is this similar in the other western states? Or do you know how we compare to the other states?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if Senator Denbro, Senator Edwards, If we compared Western states, we're in a similar trends across the West. We work closely with the 17 Western states, and as we compare data and resources and recent activities, I think you'll see general trends in the same conditions that you see across the West. And then in the next series of slides, we'll highlight some of that fire risk trend that we're seeing across the state. At a high level, I'm touching some of the key points. I'll skip right to the finances. So what do these impacts have on dollars? This is just suppression dollars. Looking at the last 3 years, here's our 10-year average. Significant cost to suppress the fires is what we're experiencing. Unprecedented there. What I don't have a slide on is loss, the landowner loss. And in this particular series of complex fire seasons, 13, 14, and 15, communities loss. Now what we've experienced. So significant impacts. This slide details the finances. This year, specifically, $76 million gross, $29.5 million net exposure. The net exposure is from FEMA recoveries and cost recoveries from other agencies. But significant as you look at the total financial exposure for large fire suppression. I want to key in on the drought conditions that we've been tracking and experiencing since 2012 with a series of slides. This is the first indicator of significant drought coming into Oregon, into the southeast corner of Oregon. This particular year, we burned 1.2 million acres of range in the southeast. That's significant to those landowners. Tremendous loss. The next year, note the drought stretching to the west and to the north. And then I'll jump right ahead to 2015 because that trend continued. We know where we stand in 2015, specifically with the counties. 25 of the 36 counties have declared drought in the state of Oregon. My hope is this is we're peaking here, but as we've heard from California, they've been challenged for many years. These are our first, this is the first decade of years that we're looking at the drought, and we're seeing these impacts trend pretty closely with fire impacts across the landscape as we track the drought. The drought conditions influence a number of risk tools that we have, and I'll highlight two risk tools. This one's out of the National Interagency Fire Center, and they look at predicted weather conditions on the landscape for us to predict the risk of fire season. We look at these a couple months ahead of time, so it is a projection on weather conditions. This is July and August of 13 in the top left. The red is above normal fire risk, so we have a gauge of what we're looking at as we go into the fire season. 2014 in the center, and then 2015. You can see this tracked with the drought pretty closely. The extension up to the northeast through Montana and Idaho, and that's where we had significant fires, including Washington. If you carry those drought slides to the north, another you'll see in 14 and 15 that drought extended up into Washington, which had a very challenging fire season. This is one wildfire risk tool that we use. The second one looks back at fire history, looks at the landscape conditions, and another number of factors to rank the risk that we have for wildfire on the landscape. I'll draw your eye to the orange and the red. Really the backbone of the Cascades. The Coast Range may surprise many people, but the history of fire along the Coast Range is significant for large fires. Scattered in the northeast, scattered in southeast, Klamath. The red highlights our greatest risk potential using this data. I overlaid just the urban community boundaries, where people live in Oregon, in the purple, recognizing the challenges we face there as we match wildland, fire, and communities. And it's hard for me to always talk about the doom and gloom here at wildfires. I'm a response type of guy and put the fire out. So I had to put out, there's a lot of prevention and obviously great suppression work, but the green highlights those communities, working in FireWise communities, recognizing the challenges, the fire on the landscape that they work in and live in. And they're taking great steps towards prevention measures. So the fire risk is not ignored at all in Oregon. Communities continue to coordinate collectively to address the challenges they face. And this information is being shared broadly so folks can plan accordingly through emergency operation centers. And unfortunately, we've been getting very close lately to communities in our coordination and planning, given the last 3 years, very much routine. And I'd say our partnership across the state for the complete and coordinated system continues to expand with new partners as fires are acting differently across the landscape and posing new challenges to us. As you consider the wildfire risk, one of the key drivers in the last slide that I wanted to highlight is we have to look at the federal landscape and the federal forests in particular. This is a study, U.S. Forest Service Forest Health Technology Expertise Team, and they did a focus work on insect and disease and the challenges that we have on those landscapes with dead and dying trees. Approximately half the forested landscape in Oregon on federal land is under some level of risk for wildfire driven by the pest and disease challenge that we have. Approximately 9 million acres. Highlighted in red, you can see the backbone of the Cascades to the south, the Klamath area, southwest area, and then the mountains in the east. So really, we have a challenging problem across the landscape. Forest health issues are driving this on federal lands. A shift to the topic in question regarding wildfire smoke. We do manage a program, the smoke management program, that we balance minimizing impacts to communities from prescribed burning with maximizing opportunities to prescribe burn, recognizing the values of prescribed burning on the landscape and balancing those interests. We do a very good job in Oregon, work collaboratively with all our partners. This slide, one of the products that that team, the smoke management team produces, is they do track wildfire emissions also. This chat highlights the wildfire emissions across Oregon across the decade. To the left, the particulate matter 2.5. This is, and I'm going to be speaking a little bit outside of my wheelhouse, so I'll stop in the detail. DEQ can speak more to the emissions piece of this, but the two components we coordinate with DEQ and Oregon Health Authority to track is the carbon tons and the PM2.5, which is the small particulate matter. So the chat details those emissions on the left, and the line chat is the PM2.5 and the CO2 emissions, the bar chat here, and that's from wildfire smoke collectively across the state of Oregon, coordinating with all our partners.
You go back one slide.
Absolutely.
Would you estimate the number of miles of contiguous border of federally protected land, BLM and U.S. Forest Service land, with ODF protected land?
Yeah.
Chair Edwards, sorry, what's that? That number is in the neighborhood of about 15, I think we have about between 13 and 15,000 shared boundary acres between lands that we protect and lands that the part of the federal estate. Say what?
Miles of contiguous.
Of contiguous boundary, a boundary area that we share with our protection on one side and federal protection on the other side.
I thought for sure that was a trivia question that he was not going to be able to answer. So I'm impressed.
It was a mush no.
The Pole Creek? Mm-hmm. 2012.
Yeah. In 2012, the legislature asked us specifically on the wildfire smoke issue to look at one fire and the health impacts to a community. 2012, this specifically was Sisters and the Pole Creek fire. You can see from the chat here we coordinated with that group and presented to the legislature in 12 on those impacts. I just quickly want to highlight the number of days where we were in the hazardous condition from this wildfire in this range here. So wildfires, as we all know, has significant impacts to public health. And we coordinate closely with DEQ and the Oregon Health Authority on monitoring wildfire smoke. And that's partly why we put out those reports annually on those emissions. So that's a coordinated effort with those partners and state agencies. With that, Doug, I hit the topics requested.
Yep.
I'll take any questions.
So what is, okay, so going back to the amount that we spent, in it looked like $74 million, then $47 million, and $29 million in years 23. I think that was 2013, 14, and 15, respectively, the last three high years. What did, I assume federal spending, this is just Oregon spending?
This is just state of Oregon spending.
This is
state
of Oregon.
Extra costs. This is not, this doesn't include the base. Our base budget is about $45 million a year for the fire department, the men and women who fight fire. Mm-hmm. These are large fire costs above and beyond that. So mm-hmm. you've got to put that base in there. And as an example, in Oregon this year, you know, we spent a total extra cost of about $76 million. The U.S. Forest Service, the last accounting, the number that I saw in early October suggests that they had spent about $250 million fighting fire in Oregon. And Doug has the number here for the Pacific Northwest region-wide within Region 6, both Oregon and Washington. It was just under $1 billion, I believe, fighting fire. The other piece I would mention is that the I know that the Forest Service has projected that by 2025, 66% of their total agency budget, not their fire program, but their total agency budget will be spent on firefighting costs. That's kind of the current estimate, given the amount of risk and exposure that's there right now on federal land.
Okay. So $250 million was this year, you said, in Oregon?
Correct. Outside on federal protection.
Okay. And then on the previous slide, I was just trying to make sense because, I mean, it's not like these are the only years that we've had large fires, but we have had 3 years in a row of large fires. Mm-hmm. Over time, it doesn't look like there's a tremendous amount of, well, in fact, you know, we're not at the high for the number of fires, but the fires are, at least lately, we're having more large fires per number of starts.
Correct.
I guess.
Yep.
So what I don't know is, you know, it looked like the 70s were the good times. A lot of fires, but they're small.
Cooler and wetter times.
Okay. So cooler and wetter times. So how are our strike resources then? Like our initial strike capacity? I mean, were we putting them out sooner, or was the landscape different?
We have
like
more.
How do you account for that difference? Because it's pretty consistent. Right. For.
I think we have more capacity. We have more firefighting capacity and more kind of technical capability now than we've ever had. I think the variable that you see in the last 3 years, and then if you look back in the 70s, the variable that's changed has to do with the forests themselves. I think you're looking at an extremely receptive fuel base. We're looking at particularly, you know, again, on lands that receive a lower level of management, they are more ready for fire. They're receptive of fire. You know, I think we have this looking back over 100 years, and it's very interesting to look back at from 1900 up until about 1940 or so. The numbers on the were left were a little bit they were larger because there was very little protection, containment, control operations there. But the variable here really has to do with the overall level of resilience of the fire resilience of the forest landscape that we have right now. Our recently retired regional forester Kent Connaughton, referring to the federal estate in Oregon, referred to it as being upside down, that it was ecologically upside down as a result of 100 years of fire suppression. And when fire starts there, it's much more difficult to control.
How many of these fires are starting on federal land and then spreading into your jurisdiction? I mean, I ask that because many of us, and I include myself in that camp, have been frustrated with the Forest Services and how federal land management has changed over the last couple of decades. And the fuel loading and just the condition of the forest, they're not very resilient right now. So, but the, you know, the 74 and 47 and 30 million that you've spent in the last 3 years on top of the base 45 million fire department costs, that's not on federal forests. So could you illuminate that a little bit? Because that's not on those jurisdictions. So, right.
So I think we could probably, Doug's got his finger here on the, for the, this last year, the number of fires on state protection, in other words, privately owned and state-owned acres versus the federal lands. We could talk about that, and then I'd like to maybe come back and make some general observations as well.
Very specifically for 2015, 2,273 fires in Oregon. So for ODF protection, just under half was ODF protection. Generally, when you look at the landscape across Oregon, ODF protects 16 million acres, and Forest Service protects about 16 million acres. So you'd expect that to be close. I would have to look at that trend and compare the two to answer the question. Specifically, that's for this year.
Very different types of ownerships. Typically, the federal ownership is at a higher elevation. The lower elevation forests, which are where there's a lot of people, where there's a lot of starts, agricultural use, other uses that are introducing fire and heat into the landscape, those are lands that we protect. You know, I think that I would say in general, on lands that are growing trees as a commodity, where there's an economic angle and there's management of those lands. In general, those lands fires do start on those lands, but in general, the level of fire resilience is higher on those lands than lands where there hasn't been a disturbance or management, where fuel loads have grown up. So I want to say that. The other thing I would want to say just clearly is that, you know, we partner very closely. We work very closely with the U.S. Forest Service, and they are, you know, they're strong fire partners of ours. And I hear frustration in their voices from time to time about the level of resource and preparation that they have to deal with the risks that they have there. So they've been good partners, and we've worked together on fire. I just want to mention that kind of as an observation.
Yeah.
You know, one of the complications, of course, is that, you know, with the checkerboard nature of a lot of these lands, you know, they're really interspersed, and so there's not a lot of separation between the two.
Exactly. Yeah.
Senator Woods.
I understand that we've had hot weather and we've had huge buildups of fuel and so forth, particularly in the federal forest lands. But I think there's also been some change in the methodology that the U.S. Forest Service has been used to attack these fires, and part of that is due to the fuel buildup and the intensity of the fires. But we've gotten away from from direct contact or direct assault to indirect and what I call the box suppression method, where you keep big, drawing a bigger box and burning in. And I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Sure, Chair Edwards, Senator Woodsett. I think I would not disagree with you. I think that there's a number of factors there. I think there's a recognition of the more complex fuel environment. Read that as a higher level of risk. I think this is a risk management decision. I think there's a higher level of risk and a perception of a higher level of risk that may affect the willingness of any particular organization to take on that risk. I think that's part of it. I think also there is, a heightened sensitivity every time we have a safety issue or a serious injury or a fatality. I think that does affect the fire culture to some extent, some parts of the fire culture more than others. I would say that is an aspect. And I do know that the Forest Service has changed policy. When in earlier days, they had a policy that they called the 10 a.m. fire policy. Their goal was to have a fire out the next day by 10 a.m. And that's not part of that suppression policy, along with changes in land management policy, have evolved over time.
And one other question.
Yeah.
We passed a law in the spring, I believe, that requires you to report on the private property losses, and I don't recall when that's required, but are you preparing that report?
Yes, we are. Yep. Look forward to sharing that with you.
Do you know when it will be ready?
So, Senator Woods, Chair Edwards, the law, House Bill 2501, mm-hmm. if I recall, initiates January 2016. We formed up preparation and organization to collect that information this year, went through the exercises. So next year, the end of 2016, is when we'll be reporting out specifically. So the 2016 fire season is where we'll have that data collected. And it's specific to fires over 1,000 acres.
Yes.
And so typically, that's, 2, 3, 4, 5 fires is where we've seen that you put that across the landscape of the last couple fire seasons, and that's a significant effort. Hopefully, we're only reporting on a few of those next year.
It's you should have written it retroactively, because I just love to see the figures this year, particularly on the ones down in Southern Oregon
and Northeast.
Yeah,
Senator Bearsugar.
I think Doug Graff might have this. You said the Forest Service spent $225 million?
$240 million.
Okay, is that, like, in your budget, you have, your $45 million budget for your fire department, and then on top of that we stack the numbers, 76?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The number you gave for the Forest Service, is that just their large fire cost, or is that their total cost?
That is the large fire cost.
Do we know what their total cost, or do they do it by region?
I don't know what their total base budget is for their fire program. We can find that out and get that to you.
I guess what I'm trying to say is we're protecting about 16 million acres in Oregon. They're protecting about 16 million acres, and we spent, 120 million, and their large fire costs are, and acres burned and stuff. I think that's something we need to look at, It's the same, but look at how big the numbers are, the number differences on suppression costs. So if you could get that to me, that'd be interesting. I don't know, maybe they do it by region. That'll only include Washington to do that, so I don't know.
We'll nail that down.
Did you guys say 16 or 60 million acres?
ODF protects 16 million acres.
1-6. 1-6.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah, get that. That'd be interesting.
Another question.
We're divided by acres.
Apples and oranges.
I had another question, but I can't remember what it was.
Better union.
So,
okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
The fuel load that we talk about here that creates these enormous fires, is this predicated on the fact that we've closed so many mills and we don't manage the forest, we don't cut the forest the same way?
That's my question.
Senator Olson, I would ascribe the largest change that has resulted in fuel buildups really to a kind of changed land management policies, and I would say that the changing manufacturing economy probably is a result of those policy changes. I think that they're all in the same bucket. I mean, they're all related to each other. But I think the kind of the leading change that triggered that really was a change in land management policy, which really coincided with with threatened endangered species, kind of the protection of particular species and the Northwest forest management plan. So it really policy change as opposed to market or manufacturing change.
Okay.
in my estimation.
But one does inform another.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was my question, okay. Is how many that I had forgotten previously is how many or are there significant numbers of geographically isolated acres that are owned by private forest owners, private landowners? It could be small, mm-hmm. a small landowner. They own, 100 acres, they own 50 acres, whatever, but they're geographically isolated. They're not close to a mill. No. So when they look at treating their land to make it more fire resilient, I go, well, where do I take the logs?
Absolutely.
So it's either an economic, they either break even at it or they make a little money managing their land, or they're forced to be hands off because there's no market.
It's an issue.
It's just money out. So.
And it may even be a negative in terms of the costs associated with managing the fuel load on your land while also paying your fire patrol assessment and the other costs associated with that. They may actually go negative, that it actually does not make sense for them to be harvesting because they're going to have to pay somebody to come do that. You take a mill like the Gilchrist Mill out of northern Klamath County, and that the timber shed that feeds Gilchrist Mill is pretty significant. And when a mill goes down like that, it affects the standing value of that timber. And another way to say that is that, for us, under the Forest Practices Act, the policy structure of Oregon is that on private land, the growing of trees is the leading use. And so our job is to keep forests working. And when it doesn't make sense for somebody to have a bottom line, those lands get converted from forest land use to other land uses. And we feel that whether, I suppose, if you look at it from this afternoon's topic, from carbon, or from any other perspective, that's maybe not in our best interest to allow to see lands go out of forest land use. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these pieces are related.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitsitt, then Senator Devereaux.
There's also another issue that I don't think Mr. Decker mentioned, but like in the Paisley area around the dead zone, several landowners like Jay Spear and others have cut their timber and staged it, but they can't afford to use the Forest Service roads, the trip charge over the Forest Service road to take their lumber to market, their logs to market, is more than the value of the load.
Sir Denver, nothing? Okay. Senator Olson? Fair Trader? You good? Okay. Thank you both for being here. I invited the Department of Forestry to start a discussion about wildfire in conjunction with our discussions about climate. It has not been lost on the chair that every single time we talk about climate issues, there are at least 12 members of the Senate that really want to talk about wildfires as well. And I respect that, and I happen to agree. And so I wanted that to be a part of the discussion. So we're starting it today. So thank you both for being here and the presentation about where we stand today.
Thank you.
So that brings us to our final item of the agenda, and that's I just wanted to fill you guys in and the general public and whoever cares to listen about what I've been working on, what I've started working on with some other folks for the 2016 legislative session. I am working on a climate bill. I'm just going to go over just like really, really, really broad framework what I'm thinking now, because it's I want to engage everybody in the discussion, and nobody's going to be shut out of the discussion. But right now, Senator Beyer and I were taking the lead on drafting a bill that would establish caps that would take us toward our legislatively adopted goals. We don't have a plan currently to get to those goals. You saw the delta that was presented in the first presentation, and some of us believe that we have an obligation to do our part. I will be the first to admit that in 2009, I think it was the 2009 legislative session, and I was in the House at that time, and I believe it was Governor Kulongoski and his team were working on pushing Oregon to join the WCI West Coast cap and trade initiative, and I just looked at it and said, you know, this is something that ought to be done federally, and I still believe that it's best done federally, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I don't think Congress has shown any interest in taking on real, you know, meaningful climate legislation. I'm thankful for the actions that the administration is pushing. I know that not everybody shares that sentiment, but I do feel like it is something that we all have to do. And if higher levels of government aren't going to do their part, and we cannot tackle this issue as a global community if the U.S. doesn't take a leadership role. So it's going to be incumbent upon states and local communities to do what they can, to do their part. Don't need to do more than their part, but do their part. So we're drafting legislation that would establish a cap program on emissions. It's contemplated that the sale of allowances, the money from that, would go to one of three broad areas. It would go to either adaptation and resilience, or it would go to greenhouse gas emissions reduction efforts, or it would go to rate relief for economically disadvantaged communities. I envision this as an opportunity to take money that is currently flowing out on fuel sources that are not clean and are harmful to our climate, and redirecting some of that into growing a clean economy here in Oregon, a cleaner energy sector, and benefiting rural communities. And that is a threshold requirement that is really important to me in this bill, is that it benefits rural communities, so that we see benefits in the forest landscape and in job creation. And as you start thinking about resilience and adaptation, and adaptation has to be a part of it as well. It can't just be greenhouse gas reduction, just straight money just spent on reduction, because we have a lot of adaptation issues. The fire issue is just one of them. Drought, water storage, I mean, that all takes money to adapt our communities to that. And so I think that we have the opportunity to come up with a plan that's going to be a win for rural economies, and I'm very sensitive because rural economies tend to be less economically diverse than urban economies. And so when the forest sector is hurt or the ag sector is hurt, the whole backbone of the entire community or of an entire region is affected. So I'm very sensitive to that, and working hard to make a good bill that benefits all of Oregon. So having said that, I know that there are scores and scores of interests that want to know what the legislation is going to look like. We won't have a draft back for a couple of weeks from legislative council. In the meantime, I'm happy to take meetings with any legislators or any folks that believe that their industry or their sector is going to be impacted, and to start those conversations. Senator Byer and I are pushing. We understand that it is a big bill for the 2016 legislative session. But if we don't do it, we need to do it in 2016 so that rules could be done for the legislature to view in the 2019 legislative session for then like a 2020 enactment date. If we do it in the 27 legislative session, the DEQ cannot write rules for this type of a program. If we were to pass it in 2017, they cannot be done by the 2019 legislative session. It's really not possible. So so we're shooting for passage in 2016. I will be spending probably 90% of my time between now and session working on this bill. I invite input from all, you know, if you want to have input, I invite you to get in contact with my office. I'm not going to shut people out. And we will also have more public hearings. We are not going to have one public hearing in February and then the next public hearing be voting on it. We are going to have more public hearings in January, at least one, and maybe more. So stay tuned, and I would appreciate any input. Senator Olson.
Senator, in light of the fact that the low-carbon fuel standard is already tripped up and has run into problems with its indirect land use, and DEQ is not able to push that program through yet, how do you anticipate getting this huge of a tax on carbon pushed through in such a short session so that DEQ can work on it? Because how are they going to be able to work on the LCFS and provide adequate documentation for this?
Well, it's a question you're going to have to ask the DEQ, how they're going to manage that workload. So you're going to have to ask the DEQ. And they weren't able to be here because Palmer, who handles all the, these things, has the flu. So I talked to them earlier today, and
probably got it from Michael.
He is quite ill. So
the point I make though is there are background. They're the ones that provide all the data and all the information. And how are they going to put that out when they at this point have trouble with the LCFS, finding that it is not going to work the way we said it was going to work in the long session?
Well, they wouldn't go straight to implementation. They'd be writing rules, so they'd have stakeholder advise at least one stakeholder advisory group, and then they would engage in the public rulemaking process all prior, so that we could see it in the 2019 legislative session before it could ever be implemented, and then we would have a chance to weigh in.
Well, I would just think that this is a billion-dollar bite of the Oregon apple in 2 months, 3 months. And that's an awful big bite.
Well, we've got 3 months of meeting with a lot of stakeholders about it, so we'll see if we can do it or not. So,
well, you have to do it.
I just want to commend you for your ambition in taking this on. I think it will be a real challenge, but I think it's a challenge that's worth taking on. My sense is there are people all over the state that are looking to us for leadership. And you're not talking about something that's going to be implemented overnight.
We're talking about a framework. We're talking about establishing a legislative framework that directs the DEQ to really get down in the weeds. And they would have a couple of years to do that. And then they'd come back and present to the legislature. So that is not developing every single little detail of the program in the initial legislation. And so, okay. Any other questions? All right. So thank you, all of you, for being here, and we are adjourned. Thank you, all of you, for being here, and we are adjourned.